Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The 13th Man by J.L. Doty, narrated by Austin Rising. Beware the curse of the 13th man, for should he not fall, all may fall before him. Prologue. Homecoming. Charlie awoke with a start, peered into the utter darkness of the ship's hold, and realized someone sleeping nearby had inserted the point of an elbow into his ribs. After 5 years sleeping chained to his comrades, he'd gotten used to that. 5 years in a Sindonese prison camp, and you got used to a lot of things. Charlie shivered, feeling hot and cold all at once, and allowed himself a moment of self-pity. He'd managed to survive 5 years of the most abominable living conditions, only to succumb to a minor scratch. It had started out as nothing, but had refused to heal. Then it began to fester, and each day grew steadily worse, and now, with his fever returning, he shook himself free of that train of thought and prayed that this time he could remain lucid for more than a few hours. He closed his eyes and listened to the darkness. Someone jerked nearby, grunted, and started scratching furiously, the never-ending battle against fleas and lice. In the distance, someone else snored happily, and close at hand, someone wheezed in a restless attempt to breathe through lungs racked with tuberculosis. 2,000 men, chained together in the stinking hold of a ship, made a lot of noise in the darkness. 5 years ago, there had been almost 5,000 of them, most wearing the livery of Cesare, Duke de Maris, many wearing that of old Rirma, Duke de Nepter, with the remainder evenly distributed among the other 7 dukes, and even some from among the king's men, all of them the legacy of a nasty little war that had cost both sides dearly. During those first days in the prison camp, they'd lost many to battle injuries, but after that their losses had stabilized at 1 or 2 per day. Men lost to any of 100 minor diseases or afflictions which, lacking any medical facilities or supplies, were too often fatal. Before they'd been dumped in the hold of this ship, they could remove the dead in some way, bury them, burn them, something. But here, in the dark, the Sindonese didn't bother themselves with the dead, and Charlie and his comrades now shared the chain with close to 100 corpses, some of them many days old and quite ripe. Charlie decided to sit up, though he moved slowly to avoid disturbing his comrades. He got his good leg beneath him and rested his back against a bulkhead, then carefully adjusted his hand and leg manacles so he didn't accidentally jerk someone else's chain. He fingered the chain for a moment, metal, heavy, rusted, noisy, like the hand and leg irons. The Sindonese could have used plast, which would have been cheaper, stronger, more humane, more efficient, but the Sindonese weren't interested in efficiency, and certainly not in humanity. Plast didn't weigh you down, didn't rattle and chink as you dragged it behind you, didn't abrade your wrists and ankles until they were raw and bloody, didn't drag the spirit down with each painful shuffling step, didn't.
Commander? Charlie recognized Roger's whisper. Is that you? You awake?
Morning, Roger, Charlie whispered.
Is it morning, Commander?
Charlie shrugged, a useless gesture in the dark.
I don't know. Could be.
How many days you make it?
Charlie paused for a moment and considered the question carefully. The Sindonese had long ago deactivated their implants, so their only sense of time came from the distribution of the daily meal of unflavored protein cake and water. back in the hellhole they'd lived in for the past year and a half, an iron ore mine on some barren rock somewhere. At mealtime each day, he'd gouged a mark in the rock of the mine tunnel where they'd lived. Before that, he'd scored their calendar for 2 years in the stone wall of their cell in some dungeon on some moon circling some planet orbiting some star. And before that, there'd been a year and a half in a prison camp on some planet while the Sindhanese decided what to do with them. After 5 years, less than half of them remained alive. After five.
"Commander," Roger whispered. "You still with me?"
Charlie started.
"Yeah, I'm still here."
In the darkness of the ship's hold, with nothing but plast and steel around them, Charlie had scratched a notch in a fingernail each day at mealtime.
"I make it 27 days.
"What do you think this bucket'll do, Commander? 2, maybe 3 light years a day?"
"If that."
Charlie's former gunnery officer wheezed and went into a fit of coughing, deep, hacking spasms that left him gasping for breath. Back home, a few days in an infirmary and he'd be as good as new. But here, Charlie gave him no more than another month or two before tuberculosis finished him. Roger rested for a moment before continuing.
"That's 50 to 100 light years. That's the farthest they've ever moved us."
"Well, wherever they're taking us, we're there. We down-transited, I make it 6, 7 hours ago."
Roger accepted that without question. They'd all learned long ago to accept Charlie's uncanny ability to sense transition, an ability none of them shared.
"Maybe just a nav fix, Commander."
Charlie shook his head. In 27 days, he hadn't been able to stop making useless gestures in the dark.
"No, we haven't up-transited, and a nav fix wouldn't take more than an hour."
"Guess we've come to our new home, huh, Commander?"
Charlie's legs started throbbing again. The pain was relatively manageable at this stage, but after 40-odd days of slow, steady deterioration, Charlie knew the pattern well. The pain and fever would both steadily grow in intensity, and in another hour or two, it would drive him into a semi-comatose delirium. Roger wouldn't admit it, but Charlie knew from the dreams that haunted him, at those times that he ranted and raved at unseen ghosts.
"Once they park this boat," Charlie said, "I want you to call a meeting of the executive staff."
"Sure, Commander. What for?"
"It's past time we chose a new CO.
"No way, Commander. You're doing just fine. As soon as your legs..."
Charlie cut him off. "How often am I lucid now? 1, maybe 2 hours a day. And it gets worse every day."
"But the immune augs are helping."
"The immune augmentation treatments are 6 years old. Too old to cure gangrene. And not old enough to let it have me quick and clean. They're just prolonging the agony now."
Roger answered with another fit of coughing.
"Shit, Roger. I'm not even going to outlast you. What have I got? 5 or 10 days? Maybe 20 on the outside?"
Roger got his coughing under control and sighed heavily.
"It could be worse. You could be Delunas."
Charlie chuckled. That old childish saying had become their motto.
"Who's it going to be, Commander?"
Charlie looked at Roger, could see nothing in the dark, but Roger seemed to know his thoughts.
"Not me, Commander. Hell, you said it yourself. I'm barely gonna outlast you."
"What about Darmchik?"
"He's an old warhorse, Commander.
He's got the rank and the respect of the men."
In his mind's eye, Charlie could almost picture Roger shaking his head, matted, lice-infested hair hanging well past his shoulders, beard halfway down his chest.
Hell, Charlie, he's got rank over you, but that doesn't make him our CO. Everyone knows that. Even he knows it. And he's not ashamed of it either. Darmchek's a good CO on a fighting ship. But this is a prisoner of war camp. Darmchek won't understand how to fight this enemy. I grant you, the CO's got to be someone who knows how to fight a ship. Otherwise, he won't command the respect of these men. But what we need now is someone who knows how to keep us alive with this shit.
Roger gave his chains a bitter jerk. Charlie felt it, and no doubt other men along the chain felt it also.
What about Andrews, Commander?
Charlie had been considering that option for days now. Seth Andrews had been XO on one of Cesare's ships and had proven he could command.
Seth is right for the job, but he doesn't have the rank. And after I'm dead, that'll just put him and Darmchek at odds. There's a way to handle that too, Commander.
And that is?
Charlie could sense Roger's hesitation.
You could give him a promotion. Give him the rank he needs. Decree it as Charles, son of old Cesare.
Absolutely not. I can't do that.
Look, Commander, I know we're not supposed to say it out loud, or even admit we know it, or even think it. But we all know he's your father, whether he's acknowledged you or not. We also know you're his favorite, and we know when he needs a military solution, he looks to you first, and...
But to use his name that way, that would be illegal.
Roger laughed into the darkness.
Yeah, it would. So are you worried after you're dead they're going to dig you up to hang you?
Charlie laughed at that.
You've got a point. And Andrews is the right choice.
Then it's settled.
Yeah, I guess so. But I gotta talk to Darmchek first. Try to square it with him. He deserves that. I'll find a way to get him alone, so don't say anything until I do.
Roger coughed for a while, one of those bad fits that lasted several minutes. The pain in Charlie's leg began to intensify, and he drifted off into a troubled sleep. But the clang of a docking boom jerked him awake as it echoed through the hull of the ship. From the grunts and groans and intensified frequency of scratching going on about him, Charlie knew his comrades were waking. Charlie happened to be looking in the direction of the cargo hatch when it cycled open, flooding the hold with a white, incandescent glare. After 20-odd days of pitch darkness, it blinded him painfully, and he closed his eyes, covering them with one hand. But in that one instant, the glare had etched an image in his memory of several figures standing silhouetted in the open cargo bay. He recalled the image, studied it for a moment against the back of his eyelids. Half a dozen people. Oddly enough, one of them was apparently wearing the flowing robes of a churchman. In that first instant after the cargo hatch had opened, the steaming, sweltering air of the hold had flowed around their visitors, and he could hear them as they gasped and choked on the stench of urine, feces, unwashed bodies, and death. For Charlie and the other prisoners, though, stench had become a rather academic concept. They switched on the lights in the hold, filling the entire space with that bright, incandescent glare, forcing all of the prisoners to shield their eyes and cower. Charlie heard their visitors talking among themselves in muffled and distant voices. He squinted through his fingers and tried to catch a glimpse of what they were doing. To Charlie's surprise, one of them appeared to be a woman. She wore spacer's coveralls, but there was no mistaking the small waist and curves, and she wore her hair much longer than most men. Probably some Sindonese bitch princess come to gloat over the enemy prisoners. The whole scene took on a surreal air, the half-dozen figures wandering among the seated and chained prisoners, tendrils of steam rising from the bodies on the chain as they picked their way carefully through the men, their hands cupped over their noses. Charlie looked at Roger, who was also squinting through his fingers. Charlie's image of a tangled, matted, lice-infested hair and beard had been quite correct.
"Do I look as bad as you?" Charlie asked.
Roger looked his way and grinned.
"Worse. At least I'm usually kind of cute. In any case, the fleas like me."
He would have smiled, but the pain in Charlie's leg blossomed into a throbbing, fiery burn. He gritted his teeth and forced his hands away from the open, weeping wound. Seeing it for the first time in days, the sight was almost enough to sap any hope from him. The cycle was beginning again, and soon he'd lose all touch with reality. Charlie looked back at the silhouettes of their guests. One was definitely a woman. He hadn't seen a woman in 5 years, and another definitely a churchman. That was odd, because the Sindonese didn't embrace the church, and there was something about the churchman, too. Something familiar, as if he was part of a distant and long-ago dream.
"My God, Rocca,"
the churchman said, shaking his head sadly.
"This is the worst we've seen."
Rocca. Charlie knew that name, and the voice that called it, and he knew then that he was hallucinating, that the delirium had begun again.
"Yeah, it's the worst, churchman. But then every batch is worse than the last."
That voice had the timbre of a crusher turning rock into gravel. Charlie wanted to weep with fear and anger. Rocca and Paul. Such a cruel hallucination.
"Duke Rirma,"
the Paul hallucination said. Charlie knew that name too.
"Look at this. I can't believe they'd be so inhumane."
Charlie removed his hand from his eyes and struggled to see the three men whose voices he knew so well, voices he had thought never to hear again. But his eyes still hadn't adjusted to the light, and all they did was tear and weep. He squinted, blinked frantically, and watched their silhouettes approach as they wove among the prisoners. The Rocca hallucination squatted down to examine one of the bloated corpses on the chain. The churchman squatted down next to him.
"This one's gone,"
Rocca said. The churchman scanned the hold of the ship.
"It's unbelievable,"
he said, his head slowly turning to take them all in. His eyes met Charlie's, and his head stopped turning. They stared at one another for a long moment. The churchman frowned and stared more intently. Charlie spoke to Rocca, his voice barely above a whisper.
"Even a hallucination should guard his back better than that."
Roca's head snapped around as if he'd been struck. His eyes narrowed. Then slowly, the large, bushy mustache under his nose rose upward as his lips broadened into a wide grin. He stood, his eyes still locked to Charlie's, crossed the space between them and squatted down in front of him. The churchman followed, glancing back and forth uncertainly between the two of them. The pain ratcheted up another notch. Charlie couldn't suppress a tremor as a wave of nausea washed through him. Rocca looked down at Charlie's pus-saturated pant leg and shook his head.
"Look at you, boy. Let you out on your own, and you can't take care of yourself."
The churchman looked at Rocca as if he were mad. Charlie had trouble focusing, but he decided to break the churchman's suspense.
"Sorry, Your Eminence. I haven't been very good at keeping up my lessons."
The churchman's eyes widened, then he grinned a grin to match Rocca's.
"Oh, Charlie."
Old Rirma leaned over them and spoke without a moment's hesitation.
"Charles, my boy,
Don't be such a stranger. You should visit more often.
The woman squatted down next to Paul, looking at all of them uncertainly, and with the steadily rising background of pain, any doubt that she was a hallucination disappeared. She was far too beautiful to be real. Charlie could feel his words beginning to slur as he spoke.
You brought me an angel. A bona fide, for real angel.
She reached out and touched his cheek.
You're burning up.
Roger reached out and grabbed her arm.
He's dying. Yeah, the Roca hallucination said. Gangrene.
In that instant, far behind them, still near the open cargo hatch, Charlie spotted another silhouette, and his heart leapt. For this was truly the cruelest of hallucinations. He could never mistake the way the old Duke moved, the way he bent and carefully looked into the face of each man he passed. Paul stood, turned, and called out to the old man.
Your Grace, we've found him.
The old Duke turned their way, looked at Paul, and frowned.
Please, Your Grace, I think you should come here quickly.
Old Cesare frowned and crossed the intervening distance carefully. He stopped in front of Charlie, looked down at him. Their eyes met, and he nodded. Charlie's eyes started to weep again. Because of the glare, he was certain. The Cesare hallucination looked at Roca and asked,
How bad? Bad, Roca said. Might lose the leg at the hip, if he lives. Rest easy, the churchman said. You're home now, part of a prisoner exchange. You're the last group. It's taken us 5 years to set it up, but you're home now.
Charlie could no longer focus.
Go away, he growled. Leave me in peace.
The angel frowned and her beautiful face began to twist and distort.
I knew it.
Charlie said at her transformation.
You can't fool me anymore.
Roger's chains clinked as he put a hand on Charlie's arm.
Did you hear that, Charlie? We're home. We're free.
Roger lowered his head, buried his face in his hands, and wept openly. Charlie shook his head.
You can't fool me, Roger. You're not real either.
A wave of nausea washed up Charlie's stomach, and he vomited bile into his lap, the fever coming on quickly. He tried to focus on that thought, had trouble concentrating. Then he saw the familiar image of his dead brother, Arthur, walking across the deck. The color of life gone from his cheeks, death hanging about his shoulders like a shroud, his body twisted and broken.
Please, Arthur, he cried. I'm sorry. Please, forgive me. Please. Charlie, the churchman said, reaching toward him.
But as he did so, his face slowly dissolved and became Arthur's face. You failed me, Arthur said. You failed our father. You failed us all. Charlie screamed. During the 800-year reign of the Plenroy, the Harlberg, and the Stefanov kings, only 12 men had ever occupied the Delunis Ducal seat, the 10th Duke of the realm, and without exception, each had come to a very tragic, most unpleasant, and certainly untimely end. Some had even brought down their entire family and clan with them. But for the past 300 years, the Delunis Ducal seat had remained unoccupied, the title unclaimed and unwanted, for it had become the stuff of legend that the downfall of the first 12 Dukes de Lunis would pale in comparison to that of the 13th. And so, no man would accept the title de Lunis. In fact, the legend of the 12 Dukes de Lunis had spawned a common saying, spoken only in the darkest hours of despair when all seemed hopeless. It could be worse. You could be de Lunis. The de Lunis legend also spawned a long, rambling poem, often chanted by children when not in the presence of their elders. In stanza after stanza, it describes in great and gory detail the demise of each of the 12, just the kind of thing young schoolboys might take pains to memorize, then chant at young girls to make them blush and giggle. Of particular interest to historians are the final few stanzas of this rhyme. And the 12th Duke de Lunis, his head rolling wide, cried, O my king, wherever shall I hide? The 13th Duke de Lunis will fare no better now, for beneath the headman's axe he'll lie, a frown upon his brow. There is one more stanza beyond the last of the official verses, but there is some question as to its authenticity, and as to whether it was penned with the original poem, or perhaps added later by some scoundrel bent on demeaning the crown. So it's not commonly published as part of the whole, though most have heard it at one time or another, and almost all are aware it exists. Few remember the lines themselves. But should the headsman miss his prey, the 13th man will rise and rule the headman's axe one day, no limit to his prize. The meaning of this last, unofficial and often suppressed stanza is the subject of considerable speculation among historians and academics. Chapter 1. Recovery. Arthur's ghost visited Charlie quite regularly, and would often plead with Charlie, "Why did you abandon me, Charlie? I thought you loved me." Sometimes the angel visited him and brought him a certain kind of peace, and sometimes the churchman came and spoke kindly to him, though at other times the churchman berated him for abandoning Arthur. But when the old duke came and stood by him, Charlie could only cry and plead for forgiveness. And then there came a day when Charlie opened his eyes, and the oddly distorted sense that he was hallucinating had gone, though the angel sat in a nearby chair reading an old-fashioned book. Charlie lay in a bed in what was clearly the sick bay of a ship. The angel remained unaware of his gaze, and he watched her for quite some time. Dark auburn hair, cut shoulder length, blue eyes set in an oval face. In the hold of the prison ship, she'd worn baggy spacer's coveralls. Now she wore a simple knee-length dress, a pair of slippers on the floor in front of her, her legs curled beneath her on the chair, her attention wholly focused on the book in her lap. Maybe he wasn't delirious. Maybe she was real. But then again, he hadn't seen a woman in 5 years, let alone been in the same room with one. So perhaps she was an ugly cow and his perspective had changed. In any case, it didn't matter. He asked, "Are you a hallucination?" She looked up from her book with a start, and her blue eyes sparkled as she stared at him for a moment.
"No. Are you?"
She put her book aside, stood, nudged her feet into the slippers, and crossed the room.
"I'll get the others."
"No," he said. "Not yet. Where am I?"
"Cesare's flagship."
"Who are you?"
"You can call me Del."
"My men?"
"I should get a doctor to answer that."
She turned away, but he reached out and caught her wrist.
"No, please. I'll just get a lot of double talk from a doctor. I need straight answers."
She thought about that for a moment, then nodded.
123 were already dead. 2 more died before we could get them off the chains. 6 more during the next 2 days. The rest, 1,927, are in varying states of health. But they're now stable, and so they should do well. The fact that she had such statistics instantly at hand said much for her in Charlie's view. Charlie shook his head, ran fingers through his hair, and fought back.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?